White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Okay, boys and girls, it's in the bunker here. It tells me it's May the 27th, 2016, and we're all ready to go. Are you ready to go, boys and girls? We'll see if we can dig up some real dirt today. I'm going to lead off today with one of your favorite programs that I put on here, The Pessimist's Guide to History. If you haven't heard it before, well, we go through history from the very beginning with all the terrible things that have happened to people. Yes, we can't stay away from that. And today we're going to cover the Great Chicago Fire, 1871. This, the most destructive fire in American history, ravaged 3.5 square miles of Chicago in just 27 hours on October 8th and 9th, killing over 250 people. It's amazing, only 250 people died in a fire that big. More than 90,000 people were left homeless, and estimates of damages reached $200 million. Chicago, at this time a booming city of about 335,000, had suffered an unusual autumn drought and the heat wave with temperatures over 100 degrees. Closely packed wooden houses, barns, shanties, and poorer west side were tinder dry and ripe for a major fire. Then around 9 p.m. on October 8th, a small blaze broke out in a barn belonging to Patrick and Catherine O'Leary of 137 DeCorvin Street. Boy, they do always blame everything on the Irish. Legend has it that Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over a lantern while she was milking. The O'Learys probably were asleep at the time, though, and the mystery of the fire's origin was never completely resolved. Fire soon spread throughout the west side of the neighborhood's maze of shanties, barns, pigsties, and chicken coops. Chicago's meager fire department did not even arrive on the scene until an hour later. But that was not the worst of it. A hot, dry wind now blew out of the west and soon intensified, with speeds recorded at 60 miles per hour. By midnight, 7 square blocks had been leveled. Flames leaped upward 30 to 40 feet, while hot winds drove the fire eastward through the lumber yards, mills, and wooden cottages. Chicago's fire department tried desperately to halt the advanced flames. But as the Chicago Tribune reported, the whole air was filled with glowing cinders, looking like an illuminated snowstorm. Whichever way the wind blew, the fire spread. Not even the Chicago River, which separates Chicago's western district from the south side, could contain the blaze. Shortly after midnight, firebrands blew across the river to ignite roofs on the far shore. First to go was the squalid waterfront section known as Conley's Patch. Fire raced through it, consuming saloons, brothels, gambling halls, and cheap hotels. Whole buildings were devoured by the flames in minutes, while drunks and prostitutes clamored noiselessly into the street. One bartender was seen madly toasting the fire just before a burning ceiling collapsed on top of him. The heroic efforts to stop the wild blaze was failed. The officials even tried to establish a fire block by dynamiting buildings. But fierce winds moved the fire unpredictably. Now tens of thousands of refugees filled the streets as the rapidly advancing wall of flames herded them towards Lake Michigan. Meanwhile, a jeweler stood outside his burning shop, handing out gems and jewelry to passing refugees rather than giving them up to the fire. One by one, theaters, hotels, banks, and even City Hall burst into flames. Chicago's near-complete destruction was assured on October 9th. At noon, a burning board carried by a raging wind sailed across the Chicago River's eastern fork into the city's affluent northern district. The board landed on the city's only water pumping station. When the station went up in flames, water for the city's firefighters was cut off, and the blaze raged unchecked. Fires jumped from one main mansion to the next through the north side, and in the end consumed all but two homes in the entire district. Thousands of refugees driven to the shores of Lake Michigan waded into the lake and stayed for hours, their faces burning in the searing heat while their bodies went numb in the bitter cold water. By 3 a.m. on October 10th, the murderous wind abated and the fire soon died out. When it was over, at least 17,500 buildings had been destroyed. Ironically, though, the O'Leary's house was not one of them. The luck of the Irish. It remained standing beside the charred wreckage of their barn. Well, there you go. That was the luck of the Irish, all right. Well, things like that happen, boys and girls, all down through history, and they'll happen again. They're happening up in Canada. Yeah, the whole town, they had to take 90,000 people and move them out. I read this stuff, so for the rest of the day, you'll feel pretty good about things. Yeah, you can't be too down in the dumps when you see how bad it's been in the past. However, beware of the future. We had a big deal here in this little town of Warsaw. About 6 months ago, they came to town with a big camera company, film company, and they made a movie right here in little old Warsaw. And that was a big deal. Everybody's all excited. A lot of people became extras in the movie and everything. Well, last night they had the premiere showing of the movie. And I and my lady went down there to see what was going on. And I'm telling you, I never saw so many people at the theater in my life. But I want to tell you something. It wasn't that hot a movie. It was really based around the upper middle class problems. You know, like poorer people can't relate too much to that. Everybody was in nice houses and nice cars and had good, great jobs and had money, see. So basically about a man and his wife, he'd known her ever since she was a kid, and after they got married, she contracted cancer. And they went, fought it, took a bunch of that poisonous chemo, you know. And beat it for a while. She went into remission. And then it came back and she died. And basically, that was the whole movie. I was sitting there. It was sort of unnerving to me because my wife, Kathy, died of the same thing, of lung cancer. And I believe this one died of lung cancer, too. And so to sit through the agony, all that wasn't too hot. But the movie was about a 4 on a scale of 10. But all the local yokels went there to see whether their picture got in the movie, because they had a lot of street scenes and so forth. And a lot of the local people got their pictures in the movie. So anyhow, the one guy, I forget his name, the Irishman, the bald-headed Irishman that's on Lost, the series TV Lost, which is very good on Netflix. He was a doctor in this thing, yeah. And, of course, they always do. They brought this old senior citizen Negro into the scene as being the prognosticator and guy who had all the cliches and things to say, and everybody just loved him. One Negro in the whole movie. I was bored to tears. I have a suspicion this film was made by some Christian-based outfit because it had all the earmarks of it. And it's New Line, I believe it was. not that other outfit that Weinstein runs, but I think it was New Line Company. But anyhow, I'm going to check it out because I think this movie is the kind they'll show around at the churches, make people feel good. First makes them feel bad, and then it makes them feel good. I just sent you a Chinese advertisement for TV that you're going to roll in the aisle. Send it out to as many people as possible. I think we need to recruit the Chinese as a natural ally. They seem to have the race thing down straight. Well, I see that the ISIS lone wolves are on the road. A Twitter account allegedly belonging to Sally Jones, the widow, ISS recruiter, and hacker Junaid Hussein, posted multiple threats to Westerners, that means white people. They always say Westerners in the United Kingdom, inciting lone wolves to carry out attacks there during the month of Ramadan, roughly June the 5th to July 5th. So we'll see what happens there. Well, here's some more news on the ISIS stuff. Yeah. Simply titling Just Terror, the Islamic State released the 12th issue of its English magazine DABIQ on November 18, 2015. In its pages, the group revealed the purported explosive device used by the Sinai province to take down the Russian airliner and suggested that airliner KGL-9268 was not the original target. It announced the executions of Chinese hostage Fan Jinghui and Norwegian hostage Ole Johan Grimskard, and featured a new article attributed to John Cantilli, in which the British captive muses that the IS might carry out a large-scale attack in the West on a par with 9/11 to compel the U.S. and its military allies to put boots on the ground in Syria. Well, probably the military-industrial complex would love to do that. Obama's been holding him back a little bit. Following is a summary of these and other selected articles from the publication. Forward section of the issue criticized France and Russia's policies against ISIS and touted the group's October 31, 2015 downing of a Russian plane in Egypt and the November 13, 2015 Paris attacks as respective justice against them. Regarding the downed Russian plane, the forward claimed that upon Russia's airstrikes in Syria, the attack was given priority over another unspecified plan to bring down a plane belonging to a nation in the Western or American-led Western coalition. I don't understand these ISIS people from a tactical situation, why they ever tried to become a mass army. I know they want to take over land and proclaim their caliphate, but it would seem that they would have been much better operating in lone wolf style all over the world. I think they've sort of split up their forces and they're doing that, you know. I think they're hedging their bets a little upon meeting who they consider the enemy head on and are now falling back on guerrilla operations. That's my opinion. And so we might expect to see some pretty big events happen in the next few months. Maybe or maybe not. I'm not trying to be a prognosticator. And so after having discovered a way to compromise the security of Sharm el-Sheikh Airport, International Airport, and resolving to bring down a plane belonging to a nation in the American-led Western coalition against the Islamic State, the target was changed to a Russian plane, and maybe now to an Egyptian plane. A bomb was smuggled into the airplane, leading to the deaths of 219 Russians and five other crusaders only a month after Russia's thoughtless decision. Well, we know all of that, so I'm not going to go on and on about that. This is pretty much old news. Pretty much old news here. As far as I'm concerned, ISIS is making many of the mistakes or similar mistakes to the IRA when it was going strong. I don't know who figures out their tactics, but I don't think it's near as bright as they would like to be or think they are. I think Osama bin Laden did a better job of bleeding the so-called West than anybody else. He was running all over the place, hiding all over the place. They were committing more material operation to that than anything else. So here's one guy with a few ragtag guys with him that really tied down everybody and caused him to spend billions. So to me, it seems like that mode of operation is more effective. But who am I to say? I'm only an ideological terrorist. I'm not a battlefield terrorist. Anyhow, guerrilla warfare is not terrorism at all. Guerrilla warfare instills fright and terror in people the same way you call terrorism. It's just a catchword. I suppose a lot of you people already know this, but next time some black person challenges you or some white bastard, whatever they want to call themselves, that there's not that many blacks murdering people. Well, go to Netflix and go to First 48 Hours, or it's on Sling Blade. No, it's not Sling Blade. I forget one. Anyhow, just find it on the internet, 48 Hours, and that's all it is. Black murder, black murder, black murder, black murder. Black multiple murder, black kid murder. Black old people murder. So just refer him to that. I watched one last night where there had been 24 murders within a couple of years in one block. And the latest one, a guy was riding his bicycle, a black guy. Another black guy walked out and grabbed his bicycle and tossed him off and put a bullet in his head right at 12 noon. And the sun was shining high, man, right? Like Dodge City. This story is the unbelievable story. But I'm sure you can. Germany probes a neo-Nazi photo taken inside Buchenwald. Oh, my God. A photo showing two presumed British neo-Nazis saluting inside a former crematorium cellar at Buchenwald near Weimar has prompted a major probe in Germany. Angela Merkel is going on her Harley down there to find out what the hell is going on. More than 56,000 persons perished in the Nazi death camp. 56,000. I thought you were yelling about 6 million. Police and intelligence agency officials in Germany, eastern state of Thuringia, said Thursday they were treating this very seriously. The photo published last Friday via Twitter by British neo-Nazi group National Action. It showed two neo-Nazi. How do they know they're neo-Nazi? What the hell is a neo-Nazi? Presumed to be British with their facial features electronically masked. Wow. Making Hitler salutes. No, those are fascist salutes, you idiot. Inside the cellar of Buchenwald's former crematorium, where people did die there, but mostly of natural causes. They had a crematorium, yeah. An arrow with the words meat hook points to a wall attachment. Built in 1940, Hitler's elite SS stacked bodies in the cellar and used an elevator to lift the dead into the crematorium room above. Inside the cellar, some 1,100 men, women, and youths were strangled to death. The SS hung them up on hooks. See, when you got the total control and influence over the press, you don't have to own the press, just influence. You can say anything. And who's going to defend... Who's going to defend the German National Socialists or the neo-Nazis? Who's going to do that? So these Jews, they get away with any story they want to spin, and everybody heads for the hills. Oh, my God, there's neo-Nazis. Oh, it's a holy place, and they're there. Ooh. displaying contempt for former victims of the German regime, not Nazi, it was the German regime, denying the Holocaust and displaying Nazi symbols as punishable crimes under post-war German law. Yeah, throw them in jail, man. Reports on Thursday said a charge stemming from the photo was lodged by administrators of the memorial site, which yearly has 500,000 visitors and marked the 70th anniversary of its liberation last year. Well, now they're going to be in trouble. The Germans are going to have to fork over a few more million bucks to the Kikes. Pay off. Please don't give us a hard time. Please don't interrupt our business affairs. Please, Mr. Jew. Only problem on something like this, some little silly deal like this happens, it gives the Jews and all the rest of the people, the Jew lovers and the Christians, the chance to go on and on and on for days and months rubbing their hands together and saying, oh, it's horrible, they're back, they're everywhere, we got to get them. It gives them that chance. Why don't people just to solve the argument in this 2016 say, frankly, Jaime, I don't give a damn. And 90% of the people moaning and groaning and crying and crabbing about this, they don't give a shit. It's all on the surface. It's all hypocritical and the whole bit. And I think the Jews know that. Well, isn't this interesting? The neo-Nazis salute Aryan goddess Taylor Swift. White supremacists believe American pop star is a closet Nazi waiting for Donald Trump to become president. Wow. Wonder where they got that information. Taylor Swift may look like every bit the all-American girl next door, but according to white supremacists, she's actually a Nazi at heart, feeding her legions of followers racist messages coded with saccharine lyrics and sick beats of Grammy-winning songs. Some Jewish singer must be jealous, trying to destroy her career. The Vice blog broadly explored the extent of the origins of that conspiracy theory. Oh, wait a minute. This is a whole different thing. Sorry, boys. Well, she can be the goddess if she wants to be. Taylor Swift. Better check her genetics. She looks real good, but you never know when there's a heap in the woodpile. Wait a minute. Here is some more. The Vice blog broadly explored the extent and origins of that conspiracy theory in a post Monday's speaking to Andre Anglin, a writer of the white supremacist blog Daily Stormer. It took me a long time to find out what his name was, Andre Anglin. Never heard of him. About the blonde-haired, blue-eyed singer's fascist appeal. Quote, firstly, Taylor Swift is a pure Aryan goddess, like something out of a classical Greek poetry, Athena reborn, unquote. Anglin said, it is also an established fact that Taylor Swift is secretly a Nazi and is simply waiting for the time when Donald Trump makes it safe for her to come out and announce her Aryan agenda. You see, this is the same thing Duke did to the famous jockey years ago, fronted her off. Now, why does this so-called Nazi think he's helping or showing respect to Taylor Swift by fronting her off like this, if it were true or not true? Either way, it can destroy her career. You know, the right wing never knew anything. They never know anything about being secret. They never have any racial security. Nothing's a secret to a right winger. I mean, so these guys come out like this and say these things about famous people, and it either destroys their career or hurts their career. So I'm suspect, like I always was of Duke and now this Anglin guy, that if they're just so stupid as to front off this talent, then you got to watch out. Watch out, boys. They do it all the time. Yep. But the worst part about it, most of the time, is just a cheap way of getting some publicity by ruining somebody's career. If a powerful person or a very popular person wants to join the struggle, then you must pull all stops to keep them secret, not expose them. I just put a message on the celebrity gossip line on the web. Duke and England are so interested in using anyone for their own publicity that they will not stop at being the destroyers of careers. Signed, Tom Metzger. Yep. Let's see here. Where am I at? Where'd I go? Where am I at? Another reason I hate right wing. Also, I think that we better quit this right-left stuff. It's been a pain in the ass for a long time. Let's stick to who's on top and who's on the bottom. That's what's really happening, even in our own race. The whites on the top or the whites on the bottom? Or the blacks on the top and the blacks on the bottom? Forget that right-left shit. Israelis think they're being overworked. Well, according to this, British entrepreneur Richard Koch has invented the 80-20 principle that argues we get 80% of our work done in 20% of our work time, and the remaining 20% of our work gets done in 80% of the time. I guess you can understand that. Israel's official work week is 43 hours long, but many Israelis work many more hours than what's common to the OECD. And still, productivity in Israel is way low. The question organized labor and the employers have been debating over the past few weeks ahead of upcoming legislation to modify the Israeli work week has been, will a shorter week reduce even further or enhance productivity? Wow. On Sunday, the Ministerial Legislative Committee, headed by Justice Minister Aliyat Sheikh, is expected to debate four different proposals dealing with the shorter work week. The leading bill, submitted by MK Eli Cohen and endorsed by a number of MKs, proposed starting the shorter work week reform with one Sunday every 2 months. Initially, we're talking about one long weekend a month, starting Thursday night and going through Monday morning, Cohen said in a recent interview on Radio 103 FM. However, he explained, after many debates, which included the Histadrut trade union chairman, Avi Nissekorn, and representatives of the Israeli industrialists, and other players, we formed the proposal we're submitting to the ministerial committee, which talks about six long weekends a year. Whoa, a lot of guys here in the country are going to move to Israel. The employers' organizations object to the move, but by weekends, it appeared they acquiesced after the threat of 12 long weekends was reduced by half. They estimated the damage to the economy at $2 billion annually. It's interesting to see that in addition to traditionalist capitalist employers, organizations such as the Manufacturers Association and the Chamber of Commerce, the long weekend enemies also include the Kibbutz Industries Association and the Farmers Union. We expect that more than a few labor Zionists, including former Histadrut chairman David Ben-Gurion, are rolling in their grave. Well, there you go. The Jews want more time off, man. More time off. That way the Orthodox Jews can have more babies, man. They can have more time in the sack at the home. Figured by now most of the Arab Israelites were doing most of the work anyhow. Don't worry about it, Jaime. You can borrow another 100 million, billion bucks from the United States. No sweat to cover. Then you can go from Wednesday till Monday morning. Yeah. Cool. Well, Israel's lost another friend. Venezuela. Once upon a time, Venezuela was a true friend and supporter of Israel. Today it attacks Israel with anti-Jew rhetoric at the UN Security Council meetings. And we're pissed off about it, they say. Uh-oh. Martina Anderson, an Irish member of the European Parliament, said Israeli lobbyists are all over this place like a rash during a parliament meeting on Wednesday. Anderson was moderating a discussion dedicated to health issues and sanitation in Gaza and Judea and Samaria when she compared the lobbying efforts of Israel and Jewish groups to the efforts of Palestinian Authority groups. Yeah. Quote, "We know that the Palestinians do not have the same capacity or personnel as the Israelis do," said Anderson. "Israelis are all over this place like a rash. They're lobbying to no end." Oh, boy. "You in trouble, Miss Anderson." Miss Anderson is a representative of Northern Ireland in the European Parliament for the Sinn Féin Party, known for its anti-Israel and pro-BDS stances. Yeah. Well, here's how not to do things. On Wednesday, May 18th, Adrian Williams, a 33-year-old black man, was attacked while loading tools into his truck. Well, that is evidence that he's working, a working-class black. By two white Toledo men, Robert Allen Pascalis, 25, and Charles Edward Butler, 33. Now, these guys are ripe to join the right wing, I'll tell you. Williams explained that the two guys jumped out of the truck and called me a nigger. Yeah, they called me the N-word. When he jumped out, I grabbed a bat out of my truck, hoping that they would back up and go about their business, unquote. The African-American, no, he's not an African-American, he's a Negro, reported that, wait a minute, he's an untouchable. If he's an untouchable, you shouldn't try to beat him up. Anyhow, they reported that one of the men, Butler, took a push broom from his truck and hit him several times in the head. While Butler continued to beat Williams, Pascalis repeatedly punched him in his face until he had a broken eye socket. He was later taken to the St. Vincent Hospital for treatment. Pascalis and Butler were arrested and charged with felonious assaults after a surveillance cam video was released showing them humiliating Williams. Pascalis was fined to pay a sum of $50,000 and Butler $75,000. Well, isn't that making a blow for the white race? Oh, what a glorious victory. If we really wanted to end racism in our society, then cases like this shouldn't be lightly handled. These two men should be given a maximum prison sentence where they'd learn all kinds of racism and come out as terrorists. That's Tommy's words there. But that's the problem. You got these guys, these are typical guys who'd be in the right wing, going down a street, seeing a black guy putting his tools in his truck, like I say, indicating he's working, going up and start beating on the guy and calling him names. That ain't the way you're going to win the war. That's going to backfire on you every time, man. Now, if you're going down the street and you saw a congressman or a senator, that might be worth it. At around 10:15 p.m. Wednesday, May the 25th, shots were fired during a T.I. concert at Irving Plaza near Manhattan's Union Square in New York City, leaving one dead and three injured. Police Commissioner Bratton said, quote, "The crazy world of these so-called rap artists who are basically thugs that basically celebrate violence they did all their lives. Unfortunately, that violence oftentimes manifests itself during their performances." A witness at the shooting, Live Hoffman, said the two groups had an argument just before the shooting. According to reports, a man identified as Ronald McFadder, 33, was fatally shot in the stomach. Another man known as Christopher Vinson, 34, was shot in the chest, but his health condition is unknown. Two other victims, Maggie Hextall, 26, and Roland Collins, 30, were shot in the leg during the conference. During the chaos. This is the way they blame it on the cops. The police claimed that there were metal detectors at the entrance of the plaza, which has a capacity of over 1,000 people. But concert attendants said they were never searched upon the entrance. Cops risk 1,000 lives by not sufficiently taking strict security measures. But when they do take strict security measures. Everybody wants to kill the cops. Who would want to be a cop? You'd be out of your mind to want to be a cop. Boy, Obama's buddy, that Jew Emanuel up there, mayor of Chicago, he's had big troubles with all those black people he supposedly loves since the rise of police brutality and corruption in Chicago. Rise has been there forever. Mayor Emanuel claims he's been working hard to establish trust in the police department. Mayor Emanuel replaced the head of the Independent Police Review Authority, responsible for investigation of police misconducts, and now wants to dissolve the board to set up a civilian commission that will oversee the police board. Emanuel wrote in a Chicago Tribune editorial that his goal is to bring safety to every community through building trust in the police department. That requires creating a new system of police accountability and oversight. You're going to get kicked out of office. He explained that under the leadership of Sharon Fairley, IPRA has taken important steps to reshape and improve its investigative efforts, but it is clear that a totality of new agents, a totally new agency, is required to rebuild trust in investigations of officer-involved shootings and most serious allegations of the police misconduct. You're never going to make those blacks happy. Jew boy, if you think you can make the... They're going to have to make a black mayor, get a black mayor in there. He'll straighten it out like they had years ago. But they still had a hell of a lot of black murders. The Chicago City mayor was accused of covering up police brutality since the fatal shooting of a 17-year-old black man, Laquan McDonald, by police officer Jason Van Dyke, a dirty white guy. Emanuel and other leaders, such as the state's attorney, Anita Alvarez, the mestizo, and the CPD, were accused of withholding video of Officer Dyke shooting McDonald 16 times. Well, he just wanted to make sure he was dead. I mean, you know, sometimes it takes a little more than one shot. One way Emanuel can start solving the problems of police brutality is by equipping these officers with body cameras and jailing killer cops. And another way you can do is installing body cameras on all the niggers in Chicago. But instead, he goes ahead replacing heads of departments, which might not produce any good result because they are of the same feather. Does that mean they're white? If the poll shows 62% disapproval rating of him, then maybe it's time for him to stop dismissing employees and leave. Emanuel, get out of town, man. Yeah. It's interesting that the chief, Obama, goes to Japan, insanely goes to Hiroshima, and then doesn't apologize for dropping those bombs. When everybody that knows anything about history knows the Japanese were trying to surrender weeks before that happened. And there's plenty of evidence on that. A lot of books have been written on it. And so anyhow, so he goes there and he makes it worse because the Japanese I know over there hate his guts, and they're out there demonstrating against him. Incidentally, the shots you see of them going into that, across the bridge to the Shinto temple, I walked that same walkway over to the Shinto temple, and it was quite interesting. But the thing is, Obama doesn't realize that Shinto temple, the Shinto religion, was the religion of the military caste in Japan. And by going over there to that Shinto temple, he's underlying right-wing Japanese nationalism. What an idiot. Then Obama calls for a moral awakening. Here we sit with thousands of nuclear heads, warheads, bombs, everything else. Israel with hundreds, maybe thousands. And we talk to the world about a moral awakening. And then you go to a country where you've dropped two nukes on and killed hundreds of thousands of people and talk about a moral awakening. God, what hypocrisy. It's just enough to gag a maggot. Another thing, would somebody out there explain to me what traditional value is? What the fuck is your traditional value? I'm telling you, these people, they throw this shit around like cow manure. I think what they mean is ruling class values, not working class values. Well, I don't know whether you're going to be shocked at this one. I'm not shocked at anything anymore. Trump PAC reaches out to, just a minute here. Wait a minute. Come on. I have a problem on my voice to print program. If I don't turn it off before I go into things on the web, it starts causing me problems. But look at this. Will the bearded and bonneted barn-building Amish vote for the clean-shaven, combed-over, casino-building Donald Trump? A new political action committee is betting $41,000 they will, called the Amish PAC. I'm not kidding you. I'm not shitting you. The new organization will target Amish voters in Pennsylvania and Ohio, Vice News reported earlier this month. The PAC is not affiliated with a single candidate, but has Republican roots. The purpose of Amish PAC's Plain Voter Project is to beat Hillary Clinton in 2016, because she ain't loving the baby Jesus enough, by turning out a deeply conservative and often forgotten block of voters concentrating on two key swing states, the Amish. Its mission statement reads, "The Amish, an Anabaptist group with German roots, who prefer to or refer to themselves as plain folk, but too many forms of technology." I remember when I was a kid going by Amish houses where they'd taken all the modern toiletries and everything and sinks and all the modern things we like to use and throw them out in the yard, unhook them, throw them out in the yard. I remember that. So the PAC will reach them mainly through newspaper ads and billboards, spending about $20,000 on each. Donald Craybill, a professor of sociology, now here it comes, and religious studies at Elizabethtown College and the author of several books on plain folk, I think I'm a plain folk, told Lancaster Online he has never heard of any top-of-the-ticket candidate aiming for the Amish before. The new PAC is to work two longtime Republican activists, Ben Walters, who worked with Dr. Ben Carson's campaign, another ding-a-ling, and Taylor Swindle, a former aide for Newt Gingrich, another Christian hypocrite, Newt Gingrich, and a graduate of Liberty University, a wacko college. Oh, man, I'll tell you, I can hardly contain myself. Both men live in Washington, D.C., where the Amish are rare. I'd say non-existent. They can't get their buggies down those damn streets between those nigger Cadillacs and politicians' Lincolns. Ben have hired a Lancaster, Pennsylvania local, owns a barn building business as director of the outreach. The PAC is betting that the conservative Amish, who number about 60,000 in Pennsylvania as well as Ohio, will vote Republican as they did in 2012. But Graybill said that the goal may be a long shot with Trump heading the ticket. Quote, "I think that on one hand they respect business leaders and they view him as a successful business leader," unquote. Graybill told the Lancaster Online, "On the other hand, his personal style and his sense of hubris and vanity are completely antithetical to Amish values of humility and so on. We only support the Amish organized crime unit." They got him, too. I'm telling you, they got Amish crooks now running around. Don't let that Jesus stuff fool you. You know, Dylan Roof that killed those 9 untouchables in the church down south. Now they're saying a bunch of them forgive him. Now this shows you why blacks can't get anywhere. But mercy is what flowed from the hearts of the families of the victims after the killing. And as we consider justice for the victims' families, it only seems reasonable to listen to what they said. Quote, I forgive you. Those were the words of Nadine Collier as tears rolled down her face for her 70-year-old mother, Ethel Lance. And she didn't stop there. You took something very precious away from me. I will never get to talk to her again. I will never be able to hold her again. But I forgive you and have mercy on your soul. You hurt me. You hurt a lot of people, but God forgives you and I forgive you. Oh, man. Now I can understand white people forgiving all kinds of people, too, but this is too much. Then there was Anthony Thompson, the husband of Myrna Thompson. I would just like him to know that I forgive him and my family forgives him, but we would like him to take this opportunity to prevent and accept the Lord Jesus Christ as his personal Savior. Those words were said 2 days after the crime, before the bodies of those killed had even been laid to rest. Grace and mercy are hard things to justify or legitimate. They don't seem instinctive or sensible. That's true. But they do sound like Jesus, who said, inasmuch as you forgive you, you will be forgiven. And blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy. Which is bullshit, because he never said it. It seems that only a profound faith in the Jesus, without evidence, could give someone the strength to say to their transgressors, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. Easy for you to say, you're still alive, dumbass, especially when it seems like they know exactly what they're doing. Felicia Standers, who survived the massacre. I always thought massacres were a few more people than nine. By faking dead, but lost her 26-year-old son, prayed that God would have mercy on Ruth. I don't understand people. Of course, white people do it all the time, you know. Blacks murder young white people and rape women and everything else. They forgive them because they're victims of the Christ insanity virus. Wanda Simmons, granddaughter of Daniel Simmons, declared with defiant hope, quote, although my grandfather and the other victims died at the hands of hate, hate won't win. So she's got that figured out. Even in the midst of unthinkable evil, love can still win. This truth lies at the heart of the Christian faith. Faith, all right, without evidence. As Jesus forgave those who were killing him. That's not logical. President Obama went down to Charleston and applauded the mercy of the survivors and ended one of his best speeches by singing Amazing Grace. He used to have a girlfriend named Grace. He snuck her in through the side door of the White House. It's noteworthy that the words of that song, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I've always gritted my teeth when I heard white people sing that song. That saved a wretch like me, you know. Get down on your knees. You're a sinner. You're wretched. Why don't you just commit suicide and do us all a favor? We're written by a recovering racist. John Newton was a former white supremacist, a captain who drove slave ships, and later decried the evils of his past and committed his life to the baby Jesus. Well, there you go. So now grace will be put on trial. Mercy will face cross-examination. Federal prosecutors will pursue the death penalty. A federal prisoner hasn't been executed in the U.S. for over a decade. Only 3 federal prisoners have been executed in the past half century. This case will raise the most urgent question. Can we as a nation do better than killing those who kill in order to show that killing is wrong? Well, yeah, just don't defend yourself. Pray to Jesus. He'll take care of you. No problem. No problem. If not him, maybe Abraham. Which brings you to the understanding that most society is insane. Literally insane. In reality, the friends and neighbors and family of Dylan Roof should be trying to break him out of prison, and the blacks should be trying to break in to kill him. That's normal. That's natural. All this other stuff is bullshit.
Many people imagine Jesus as a really nice man, offering kindly words of hope and reassurance to the poor, the desperate, and the lost. Isn't he the guy who preaches love of neighbor and of enemies, of going the extra mile, of forgiving 7 times 70? Surely these are the words of a great humanitarian, of a supreme moral teacher. Well, sorry, pal, this supposed paragon of moral virtue is an illusion. When you remove the cotton wool from your eyes, you will realize that the stylized character of Jesus the Lord is a rigid, intolerant authoritarian, spouting a venomous creed, simplistic and cruel. Let's begin with one of Jesus's most celebrated dictums, love of enemies. As it stands, that idea has always struck me as a most ridiculous precept. At best, it is an extravagant exaggeration of a simple enough principle. Treat your opponents with civility, your enemies with humanity. The Greek philosophers were certainly attuned to such notions of moral virtue when dealing with their adversaries, long before similar words were put onto the lips of Jesus. But what would love of enemies really mean? Let's be guided by Jesus' own behavior. How does Jesus himself deal with his own enemies? Throughout the Gospels, Jesus runs up against those notorious scribes and Pharisees, who, quite reasonably, question his odd teachings and behavior. How does the Lord from heaven respond? With love? No. On the contrary, with curses and with threats of eternal damnation. The man famous for his condemnation of hypocrites is himself a hypocrite. Jesus makes abundantly clear that his love of enemies extends only to those enemies who have fallen at his feet in abject submission. He deigns to love them only because they humble themselves before his absolute lordship. He that believeth not shall be damned, says Mark. And just as Jesus' so-called love is indiscriminate, so too is his retribution towards those who don't immediately bend their knee. Jesus threatens destruction and everlasting torment to entire cities for their reticence to immediately embrace him as their new Lord and Master. Or, as Matthew puts it, it will be more intolerable for them on the day of judgment than the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. What we have here are the brutal ethics of a pre-modern warlord, poised before a besieged city with his murderous horde. Immediately embrace me as your king, and my mercy will allow you to live on as a slave in my kingdom. Or else every last one of you will die a horrible, lingering death. And this is a Jesus, a character presented to young children as a figure worthy of reverence and worship. But let's move from enemies to those nearest and dearest to us, family. Again, we see in the Jesus figure that same streak of simplistic intolerance, lacking any normal human compassion. According to Matthew, Jesus allows divorce, to a man that is, solely on the grounds of his wife's infidelity. According to Mark and Luke, not even is that option allowed. Any remarriage is an act of adultery. Now this is a cruel, simplistic and wrong ethic. If we were to follow these teachings, as the church in Europe did for centuries, married people would almost certainly face a life sentence of domestic violence, physical and psychological abuse, and sheer misery. Today, we recognize the limitations of marriage. We are enlightened. The words placed in the mouth of Jesus are the sentiments of a primitive, barbarous culture. Could we say that Jesus is the upholder of strong family values? He does, after all, preach the brutal doctrine that the person who speaks evil of his father and mother should surely die. But let's get real here. Might not some children have perfectly good reasons for not honouring their parents? From end to end, the moral code of Jesus is crass, simplistic, and above all, irrelevant to the 21st century. But then again, at least let's take comfort in the fact that it isn't true. It isn't history. It's just more astounding rubbish from the New Testament. Let me tell you a little bit about St. Teresa of Avila, a Carmelite nun in 16th century Spain. She became famous as a mystic, as a mortifier of her flesh, and as one who experienced Jesus in bodily, though invisible, form, in episodes of religious ecstasy. And it was for these episodes of religious ecstasy that St. Teresa becomes most famous. Here's how she described her encounters with Jesus as she lay alone at night. I saw in his hand a long spear of gold, and at the iron's point there seemed to be a little fire. Jesus appeared to me to be thrusting it at times into my heart, and to pierce my very entrails. When he drew it out, he seemed to draw them out also, and to leave me all on fire with a great love of God. The pain was so great that it made me moan, and yet so surprising was the sweetness of this excessive pain that I could not wish to be rid of it. My soul is satisfied now with nothing less than God. Well, it reminds us all, I'm sure, of that Meg Ryan moment from When Harry Met Sally, except St. Teresa wasn't faking the ecstasy. On the other hand, it was her lover, Jesus, that was imaginary. Is it any surprise that Christianity draws into itself the lonely hearts and the abandoned? To be unloved, to be denied a focus for the primordial force that impels all life to seek out reproduction, leaves dangling an emptiness, a longing, and an unworldliness which becomes the breeding ground for delusion, mysticism, and religion. The sufferer battles with and punishes his or her physical self and escapes into a psychotic realm misinterpreted as higher, spiritual, or even heaven itself. Jesus is not merely an imaginary friend, he is also a fantasy lover. The innate human desire for an intimate relationship with another person finds its ultimate fulfillment in union with Christ. Jesus may exist only in the mind of his adoring paramours, but then what object of adoration does not owe more to the self-delusion of the admirer than to the objective excellence of the admired? Unsullied by any compromising physical reality, Jesus transcends our wildest hopes and doe-eyed dreams. His limpid gaze never fades, his hair never thins, his waistline never thickens. Pubescent teenagers, the bereaved, the lost, the lonely, and the chaste, all may find comfort and protection in the God-man's ethereal embrace. His love is unconditional, his fidelity beyond question. Did not this supremely selfless lover suffer agony and death 2,000 years ago? Because even then he knew he would love us for all our frailties and failings. His is a love that truly will last forever, a bottomless, infinite, eternal vat of love. How can reality compete?
Now we can see a new world coming into view. A world in which there is the very real prospect of a new world order.
The new world order does not mean surrendering our national sovereignty or forfeiting our interests.
How can I contain this anguish and this pain? No.